Hello, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. And this is your Head School Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. Now, this Head School is coming to you virtually from West Cork. It was meant to be part of the West Cork History Festival, but like everything else on the planet, it has moved on to Zoom. And we're very grateful for the support of Dublin Port for this podcast. Now, our topic today is Ireland, Empire and the Sea. The great voyages of discovery, Christopher Columbus, Vasco da Gama, etc., shifted the centre of gravity of European maritime trade from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic. Over the same period, the conquest of Ireland was completed. By the 18th century, Ireland, for centuries on the periphery of Europe, found itself at the centre of this newly formed Atlantic world as part of the British Empire. So today I'm joined by Aoife Bannock. Aoife, of course, is involved in the Irish Garrison Towns Project. Claire Connolly of UCC. Lara Joy, a regular History Ireland contributor, who's the Heritage Officer of Dublin Port. And finally, David Murphy of Maynooth. So you're all very welcome. Okay, if I go to Lara and David, just to get us started. When I say the Atlantic world, you know, what do I mean? What do we mean by the Atlantic world? What was it? Where did Ireland fit into it? Lara?
The Atlantic world is kind of following on from where the centre of the world had been prior to that, which is very much based around the Mediterranean Sea. And what you start to see from the 1500s and 1600s is this move westward and the connections between Europe and the expansion of these amazing super empires of Spain, Portugal, Britain. But essentially every European country is now involved in this huge move west, expansion, trade. And of course, at the centre of it all is the slave trade, and very much the rise of the slave trade from the 1600s, the dominance of it by the British Empire, and particularly the Royal Navy, until it was banned in the early 19th century. And that's the central part of the Atlantic world. But it's that connectivity that many people don't realise how connected the world was at this stage. Again, it was dangerous sailing on the Atlantic, but it was very much a connected world, and one that is a fascinating story.
Can I just, in terms of geography here, I mean, it just struck me now, and this we come back to the kind of sea blindness issue, Lara, with you, you know, that. But really, because we were on the edge of the world, there was no reason for us to venture any further, you know, up to this point. Would that be correct to say, you know, that we were on the edge?
We're on the edge of the world, and there was no expansion. The people who went any further were mainly fishermen. So you do see fishing fleets going off to Greenland, chasing cod and things like that. But fundamentally, the world is very much based in and around the Mediterranean Sea. That is the world and the center point of the world. And then you start to see the expansion, this need to kind of connect up with India and China, and this need to kind of expand and explore. And that's where Columbus and everyone else kind of is out there trying to see the modern world and how big it is. And when we look at the Atlantic world, you know, it is all South America, the whole of South America. It's the Portuguese and Spanish empires that are down there. And later on, from the 1800s, the series of revolutions that we associate with this Atlantic world. So it is very much the whole of the Atlantic, South America, Africa, Europe and North America.
David, can I bring you in here? I mean, has anyone quantified this? I mean, what figures on this, like in terms of the expansion?
I'm sure, I mean, there has been literature. There is a literature on this, and there has been studies done on this. And you can mark it out. You can see it in different phases. I mean, as Lara was mentioning there, the initial impetus to this is to travel westwards, hopefully with the idea of reaching China and India and locations like that. And almost by, you know, by accident, you find out there's a couple of different continents there in between. So you can actually mark the different phases of, you know, exploration into the east coast of America and then down into what we would look at as Central and South America. And then there's different phases that, you know, kind of, well, then we will see landward, inward exploration in from the east coast of America. So, you know, by the middle of the 18th century, we're looking at basically most of the east coast of the Americas being explored, and then also a decent enough chunk of the interior. Quite often as well, we think America is discovered and all of America is discovered, but there's an inward expansion, as we know, that will take place all the way into the mid-19th century. There are places in the interior of America, the United States, that are totally unknown until the mid-19th century, and even later for kind of South America, Central America. So it all begins in phases, and then it brings, like, if you need stop-off points as well, you know, South Africa becomes an important place to kind of stop off if you're going to then move westwards and head to South America. So the acquisition of South Africa becomes an issue for the Dutch, and then becomes an issue between the Dutch, the British, and the French in the 17th and 18th centuries.
Now, Claire, I think you sent me this quote here from Barry Crosby, I think. Is that you, Claire, was it?
He said,
Ireland moved from outpost of empire to sub-imperial centre in the early by the early 19th century. What was the context of that quote?
It's his book on, you know, tracing Irish relationships with empire, and just strikes me as a really good way of summarising that dynamic that we've been talking about of moving from being, the absolute periphery of the classical Mediterranean world to somehow now becoming at the start of the modern period, the centre. And I suppose you could add to it as well. It was just thinking as we were talking there that that move from being on the edge to being in the middle repeats itself on the within the island of Ireland too, where extremely peripheral places on the coasts become actually quite central to the kind of naval fortifications and security of the coasts, which becomes a way, of course, of defending empire. So
You're talking about Cork here, which has been the centre of the universe ever since.
Well, indeed. But in fact, I was thinking of Waterford. I was just in Tramore on Sunday. And, the Metalman fortifications there on the coast, they're in such a kind of out-of-the-way, picturesque spot. And, of course, then that is central. Or indeed, if you look at West Cork, the way you could signal from Spain Tower to Galley Head and out along to Cape Clear or whatever, this becomes it's almost like a fractal repetition of this kind of centre to periphery move.
Right. And how did empire shape our relationship with the surrounding seas?
I have a theory of my own that I think it's kind of left a legacy for us. What Lara will talk about in relation to sea blindness. But I think the very centrality of empire as kind of defining the relationship with the seas maybe helps us understand some of our unease a little bit with our relationship with the sea.
Okay, so you're suggesting then that our concept of the sea is wrapped up with the concept of empire.
I think it couldn't but be, yeah.
Okay, well, and we're going to try and unravel it here over the next hour or so. I want to get on to you, right, because I want to talk about the nuts and bolts of this, right, because, and maybe first of all, moving away from the sea slightly here, just look at this from the military point of view. Now, Ireland was recently conquered, really, completed by the 1690s. I think we'd all agree on that. But why was there such a large, you know, British military presence in Ireland, including naval?
The main reason there's such a large presence of garrisons, of barracks, is because it's the largest recruiting ground for the British Army. Even from before it's technically legal to have Catholics serving under the British flag, they are sending a lot of Catholic recruits out of Ireland to police the empire. In fact, they start recruiting them in the late 18th century, specifically so that they can send them abroad. It's only really after that Catholics are allowed to serve legally that they are used to police Ireland and the UK as part of the British Army. So really the main reason that there are so many barracks here isn't just because of policing duties within Ireland, although that's important. It's because this is the main reservoir for men. And it's the easiest place to feed men while you train them as well, because there's an agricultural system.
You're suggesting it's recruitment rather than policing is the key thing.
Certainly for the large barracks, and I'm talking the late 18th century epic fortifications. They're not fortifications, they are a different style of architecture. But they're still in our cities today. I mean, Cork Barracks, which is now known as Collins Barracks. The Royal Barracks in Dublin, of course, is Collins Museum, which is the most, you know, it's the most iconic one, really. It's the one that we're all most familiar with because it's so beautifully preserved and it's on the river. And those barracks are used to train large numbers of men who are then shipped out via the Royal Navy out to the Empire. So there is this intrinsic link between the seas and those huge barracks, even though they are inland, often in towns like Fermoy or Buttevant. And Limerick is one of the most garrisoned cities in the country, and that supports cities. So, you know, there's a lot of connections there.
So you're suggesting that the purely military side of this is intimately connected with the naval, with the sea?
Very much so. Right. I mean, the British Army can only transport troops because the British Navy does it. And it's quite a complicated bureaucratic nightmare, actually, for the Royal Navy, because they have to be paid per head of troop that they ship around the world. So there's always a lot of negotiation on, you know, embarkation and all of that. So it can be quite complicated when they're trying to move horses and soldiers' wives and soldiers' children and baggage. And it's all part of this massive machinery of empire that's driven by bureaucracy and by the movement of people and goods.
Now, these I'm assuming this is all hungry people, you know, have to be fed, watered and so on. So what effect did this military establishment have on the Irish economy, particularly the naval?
A lot of people required a lot of food. Within the garrison towns, men have to be fed all of the time, daily. So all of that food comes from the local hinterland. And those contracts are often secured by like local shops and local pubs. And because of the contacts they make there, they can then secure further contracts for, say, for example, in Fermoy, some of the shops in Fermoy are supplying Temple Moor and the harbour forts. So you can see how there is a link between even an inland town like that and the harbour and the naval situation there. And certainly to provision the Royal Navy, I mean, that's really what the butter trade and the salted beef trade are about in Munster, and particularly in Cork City. A lot of that is going to supply the Navy and the Empire.
Claire, did you want to come in there on that?
I suppose I was thinking when we were talking about it before, about just the kind of how kind of complex and necessary these connections that then become. So as Aoife was saying, it's this huge machinery, but it also feeds into a kind of an imagination of the sea and the connections between Ireland, Britain and across the empire.
Claire, you in our discussions before this, you introduced the concept of quote unquote colonial improvement, right? You know, we in Ireland here have been subject to this for many, many generations, right? What does that mean? And what is its connection with the sea?
Well, it's funny, if you do, how could you improve the sea? It's a funny idea, isn't it? But if you look back at the natural history and political and writings around that period of the conquest that you were talking about, Tommy, you find these kind of efforts to, as it were, tame the sea, to shackle the sea. And in Bolt's natural history, for example, which is usually described as the first natural history, you know, his brother came over with Cromwell. He was a physician. And he sort of has, he has a whole chapter which is called something like "The Irish Sea, Not as Rough as It Is Bruited to Be." And makes the argument that the you know, if it's rough, it's no rougher than other seas, and if people get sick, it's not too bad. And it's part of this wider project of thinking about kind of how necessary the connection across the sea is. Elites, armies, migrant workers, soon to be, you know, 19th century professionals, politicians, writers, lawyers, and so on, will all have to make that journey. So there's a kind of an interest in making the journey come to seem more normal and natural. So you find, for example, in the writings of Maria Edgeworth, who is very much an improver in all kinds of ways, in her plots, there is never rough weather. Ships always sail on time.
But she's from the Midlands, right? Did she ever see the sea? Right.
She crossed it many, many times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, mention has been made of the Royal Navy, right, which in many ways is at the centre of our discussion. David, just come to you on that. Now, I think most people will recognise that the dominant position of the Royal Navy declined after the Second World War, right? But my question is, when did it first emerge? When was it clear that the British were the biggest show in town on the sea?
Well, I think if you talk to a British expert in the Royal Navy, they will tell you that when they put their first canoe in the sea, the Royal Navy was world dominant. And that is very much the narrative they like to tell us, and you know, they will maintain to this day. I can't remember what the last statistic is in the Royal Navy, but I believe it has more admirals than it has ships. So it is no longer number one dominant. It's easy to say it this way. It goes through phases. In the mid-17th century, they're challenged, particularly by the Dutch. I mean, we like to forget this, but there are Dutch warships just sailing up the Thames to challenge and threaten London, etc. And when you get to the, say, towards the end of the 18th century, it is the fact that they lose naval dominance off the American coast. And that is the French actually have supremacy. That's the main reason that they lose at Yorktown. That's the main reason that they lose the Americas. But what we see after the Napoleonic Wars, definitely in the Napoleonic Wars, we have a huge expansion of the Royal Navy. And they become the dominant navy in those wars, in humbling the French, in blockading the French, in Battle of Trafalgar, etc., etc. And they managed to maintain that post-Napoleonic Wars by...
Can I just interrupt you just one second, right? Were the British lucky that their major enemy, the French, right, that the French Navy was very much a royalist service? In other words, like that the cream of the French Navy defected to the royalist side. Some of them became emigres. Is that true? I mean,
I think there's a double factor, like the French Royal Navy, and actually there's an interesting project there in terms, I've done some research in kind of... finding French officers who were Irish-born French officers in the Ancien Régime Navy. There's a couple of hundred of them. But it's very much a royalist navy. That ethos disappears after the revolution, and the French navy goes through a period of decline. And it's not helped by the fact that Napoleon himself has sea blindness. That's recognised. I mean, he has strategic ambition to invade England, expeditions to Egypt, expeditions to Malta, but he does not pay enough attention to the naval aspects of his forces, and that's pretty much acknowledged.
Now, what was the, just getting into the nuts and bolts here of the Navy, what sort of infrastructure are we talking about in Ireland, for example? How did it operate?
I suppose the main infrastructure in Ireland would be Hull Boland, would be that base, but they would also have various other bases around. I mean, you know, Lough Swilly, Limerick, Waterford, dotted around the country. And as Claire was saying earlier on, I mean, usually you will find a naval base and associated fortifications on the coasts to actually protect that. I mean, if you look around Cork Harbour with the various forts, it must be, by the end of the 19th century, it must be one of the most fortified naval areas in the world. And it goes beyond the coastal forts, it goes beyond coastal batteries. They have torpedo batteries in, they have nets in, etc., etc. Extremely elaborate and extremely expensive defensive infrastructure to put into place.
What was their relationship with the Coast Guard, for example? Was that part of the Royal Navy, or was that a separate service?
It's a separate service, but it comes underneath the Admiralty. And quite often what you find in terms of personnel, in that the officers would be seconded from Royal Navy, and quite often the junior, the enlisted personnel and the petty officers would be former Royal Navy, or sometimes Royal Navy seconded on. So it's all part under the same umbrella.
And no, but the point I'm getting at here is that the Coast Guard would be the personification of what we're talking about here. And what I'm getting at is that it goes right down to every single small inlet and harbour. Claire, let's go back to your point that it fractalizes, if that's a correct word, you know what I mean? That it's, you know, it goes in very small units into the local.
I mean, I was up around Lough Swilly there recently, and you come into these rather small inlets, and you find Coast Guard houses and Coast Guard stations even down at that level. And you've got the Coast Guard eyes, and also Customs and Excise have posts all around Ireland as well. So it goes from big, you know, something like Fort Camden on the banks of kind of like, in, you know, part of the Cork infrastructure, down to something that might be a small boathouse with an attached office, attached domicile, and half a dozen people crewing it. So we did, back when you think about it, back in the early kind of early 1800s, mid-1800s, we had better visibility around our coasts than we do now.
Aoife, can I bring you here in on this? Because obviously, if you've got a large military installation, naval or military, what sort of effect would that have on the local social, cultural, and economic life.
The effect of these huge installations with hundreds, sometimes thousands of men was really profound. The term garrison town is something that people understand in the same way they understand mill town or pit town. You know, these are places shaped by, in effect, the predominant industry. And the predominant industry in a garrison town is supplying the food, the drink and the fodder to the men and the horses. In 1888, Limerick was threatened with the loss of one of the regiments. And the mayor said he thought that the provisioning was worth 35,000 a year to the city. Now, that's a vast amount of money for just one industry, effectively. And that was only one of Limerick's four barracks that they were talking about. So it has a profound economic effect within the society, certainly in the, for example, the sporting revolution is one of the most obvious cases. And that's the late 19th century, when the military promulgate the idea of organized team sports or organized individual sports and competitions. And that's something that we still live with today. You know, funnily enough, a lot of the old barracks after they were burnt and abandoned in the 20s, they became playing fields. So the very presence of these barracks allowed our sporting culture to continue. And it was a sporting culture that was inspired a lot of the time by the military in the first place. And that's before we even talk about horses and hunting and steeplechasing and all of that, which within Munster is a vast industry today and was driven by those huge cavalry barracks. And also officers, of course, required a number of horses, which they would purchase locally. So the Irish horse trade, which is something we know about, has...
I thought it was all down to Jack Charlton, you know, but anyway, no, that's an interesting point. Now... Lara, I want to talk to you about recruitment, right? Because it brings up the whole question of press gangs, because that's the sort of the popular image, if you like, of naval recruitment. Presumably, press gangs only operated during times of crisis when they were short of manpower.
Yes, it was during times of crisis. So the various wars that David was talking about, particularly the Northern Punic Wars, press gangs, of course, are in TVs and books, so you have this kind of impression what they're about. But in reality, they were looking for other sailors. They weren't going around picking up laborers or agricultural workers. What they needed was people who had skills on ships. So the last thing you want to do is take a landlubber and put him on the ship because they wouldn't know what to do. So
how did they do that, Laramie? Did they get them to fill out a form first before they over the head?
they would hang out in dockland areas and port areas, and they were looking for people who understood the sea. So it's dockers themselves, longshoremen, people who worked around the port, but in particular people who were working on the merchant ships. So you also have situations where ships would at sea pull over merchant ships and impress crew. And that's what they're looking for, is a very experienced seaman. The relationship on ships, you're tied to your ship while you're on it.
Sorry, just go back there now. Sorry. So the thing is, it was legal for, say, the Royal Navy to impound another vessel and take half their crew or whatever. That was legal.
There's actually an act that is covered by the British Parliament to do this.
And was the original ship owner compensated in any way? Or was it tough?
As far as I know, no. There were rules and regulations within the act to pay them. But in the same way, when you were being impressed on service, you were also encouraged to take the Queen's or King's shilling, although you were being impressed into service. But the point I'm making, though, there are rules and regulations to this. You can't just kind of go from Cork and kind of go into Fermoy and start picking up any local lad hanging around in inland town. You needed to find people who had the skill set and actually had worked on ships before. So you just couldn't pick up everybody that you wanted to pick up on. So yeah. There are rules and regulations to it. And you do get court cases where the person in charge of a press gang ends up in court because they overextended what they could do and the powers that they had.
But were these, I mean, did these lead to violent confrontations, or is that just something of folk imagination?
In particular, I haven't come across Irish ones, but in England, when they go into towns, like Aoife was talking about, like towns that are associated with mill workers or towns that would have had an industry themselves, you do end up with riots, you end up with shootings, press gangs having to defend themselves and shooting and killing civilians, which again also end up in fairly complicated court cases. So they're not outside the Navy, they're not an appreciated group. But the as portrayed in the movies, that you're simply walking along the streets and you've never been on a ship on your life and then suddenly get hit over the head. That's a very, very small group of people that would have happened to. What they wanted was experienced people to go on board ship. But the point I was going to make about being on the ship is that later on in the 19th century, and when you're in the Coast Guard and in the Constabulary, you're joining for a set period of time. It's a life kind of contract. When you're looking at the 1800 or the 1700s, your time is on the ship. So once you leave the ship, once the ship has kind of done what it has to do, you had the right then to move on to a merchant ship or move on to a different ship. And the way that the Royal Navy kept control of you at the time was to pay you sometimes to a year or 2 years late. So that was their way of controlling you, that you might get you on board ship, you're getting fed. From a certain point of view, the ships themselves are overstaffed and heavily crewed. So the workload isn't as bad as, say, on a merchant ship. You have good food and good access. But the one thing that you're not going to get readily, of course, is cash. And that's a way of holding you on board the ship. So your kind of allegiance to the ship is that someday you might get paid.
Now, my area of study was the 1790s, the United Irishmen, and the press gangs were used as a counter-revolutionary tactic. Yeah. And I always assumed then that meant that the 60% of naval ratings who were Irish, you know, were seething with resentment and revolutionary ideas. But of course, there was another factor at play. David, I might bring you in here, in that once, even if you were press ganged onto a ship against your will, once you're on the ship, you're part of a collective and sometimes lucrative enterprise, are you not?
Sure. I mean, especially in the Napoleonic Wars, it's in your best interest to get on board a program, so to speak. I mean, because if you take an enemy merchant ship in particular, that will then be sold off for prize money. It'll be, as you referred to, condemned at the Admiralty Court and be sold off for prize. So it'll be valued. It'll be split up into a series of shares. And so many of those shares are divided amongst the crew. The captain gets a full share, the officers get a share, etc. I think it's a system of eights. Maybe Larry, you can remind me of that. I think it's a system of eights. So the crew gets two or three eights of the value. So it's in your interest to get on board this program, because apart from your payments, whenever that will actually show up, you could also be getting a share of this prize money. And if you take something really nice, I mean, what are the juicy prizes in around that time? Yeah, I mean, because of the course of the Napoleonic Wars, the British would find themselves at war with the Dutch. A Dutch Indiaman, East Indiaman, could be carrying all kinds of cargo, very highly valued by the Admiralty Court. And you could make yourself, even as a common sailor, you could come away with a serious amount of cash on one cruise, on one event like this.
Claire, did you want to come in on this?
Yeah, just to say that it can be very hard, of course, to recover the voices or the experiences of, you know, ordinary men who served in the Navy or were press ganged and so on. But we do have the really interesting case of the Limerick novelist Gerald Griffin, who was writing at the period just at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and who sets a lot of his tales around the Shannon Estuary and often features characters who have just come back from naval service or are about to embark on it. And there's one particularly interesting story about a young man who in the story is supposed to have served aboard the Victory with Nelson. He's been with Nelson holding his hoary head in his hands, kind of thing. And he finds himself through a series of accidents accused of murder when he returns to his home in County Clare. And there's this kind of really dramatic scene where he stands in front of the judge and he says, you know, when I served with Nelson served on behalf of my country, I was not a murderer. But now here I'm held guilty of a crime. And that kind of meaning of what it meant to be in uniform, to come off the ship and walk through Limerick or Tralee or whatever, is really well explored in those stories. You know, they're not ones we read often enough now, but I think we can get back to some of those kinds of experiences.
Aoife, can I bring you in on this, like just moving on, following on from the press gang thing? I mean, was this, you know, was violent conflict a constant theme, you know, in garrison towns and port towns between the locals and the military establishment?
It was very frequent. There was a lot of mostly kind of drunken brawls on the streets, and civilians got very heavily involved in these. It would depend really on the sort of provocation that was offered and the roots of each conflict. One of the most important reasons that you know, there's brawling on the street is actually because the police are trying to control the situation. And it's the police who bear the brunt of it a lot of the time. Because a lot of the time, the enlisted men, whether naval or army, are, of course, a little bit drunk. So as all police forces are familiar with, trying to police late at night, a lot of drunk people, especially a lot of very young drunken men, is extremely difficult. So the police get caught in the middle when this violence breaks out between the civilians and the enlisted men. A lot of the conflict within a garrison town or a port town can be related to how commanding officers are behaving and the sort of tone that they are setting for their regiment. For example, if in Limerick, the big dispute with the Derbyshires in 1888 is really driven by the commanding officer who gets them to sing Rule Britannia at every opportunity. This is his decision. And obviously, singing Rule Britannia daily in the middle of Limerick City, in the middle of the land war, was kind of provocative. So once he stopped doing that, because the War Office actually sent someone to tell him off, the violence stopped. So the people weren't objecting to the British Army as a concept or even the British Army policing the land war, but more like, why do you have to rub our faces in it and be so aggressive? And so these incidences can flare up and be very serious, but then they can vanish just as quickly. But they are a permanent feature because if you put a lot of men who are very young and who have access to drink in one place, there will be violence and there will be problems.
Now, I want to just pivot the conversation a little bit, bring you in on this, Claire, because as Ireland, first of all, is conquered by the British, becomes part of this larger Atlantic world, but that also involves increased traffic across the Irish Sea, right? A lot more traffic. I mean, it becomes a commonplace for people to travel back and forth. What effect does this have on the Irish imagination, or indeed on the English imagination?
Yeah, I suppose if you take the English imagination first, there's a scene I love in Jane Austen's Persuasion, where they're all sitting around the dining table talking about the West Indies, and you know, in the background is slavery. And somebody says to Mrs. Croft, the Admiral's wife, "Oh, have you ever been to the West Indies?" And she says, no, I've only been about the home waters, you know, Cork, Lisbon, and so on. And there's that sense that there is a kind of, somehow now these waters are naturally taken in as part of Britain. So,
sorry, Claire, just on home waters, because straight away I'm thinking of, you know, BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast, right? And it just relaxes the end of your day, you know. No, but I mean, especially if you're English, British, or whatever word you want to use, the reassurance that provides, and it kind of paints this world. I mean, Trafalgar is mentioned, which is off the coast of Lisbon, does it not? Sorry to interrupt, but I mean, is that what you're talking about here?
Yeah, and it's that idea that once you sort of, as you say, lean back and take in this kind of island view, go back to our fractal thing, the archipelago of the two islands sitting here together at the edge of the Atlantic, it could very easily dispose one quite naturally towards a unionist perspective, if you think about it that way. You know, the sea is crying out for union. Was it Gladstone said that? Those kind of, and indeed, it's arguably true of some of the history of the seas, that it can be hard that we have kind of like parallel histories of the seas, you know, the sea in revolution and separation, the sea in union and connection. And of course, the challenge now is to get past that and to tell the more kind of complex story like we're trying to do today. And so, you have that kind of idea of the home waters from the British perspective, and Ireland is taken quite naturally inside of that. And then from the Irish side, it becomes just such a routine and inevitable and necessary part of many aspects of life, administrative, fiscal, financial, and so on, simply to have to cross the sea. And so it's not only the sea then, but the roads and the rail, and that whole kind of wider infrastructure of connection between and across our two islands really shapes our imagination.
Now, it also gives rise to Holyhead, right, Claire? And I know Jonathan Swift had a few things to say about Holyhead.
That's right. Well, one of the great things about Holyhead is it allows us to see a sort of pattern, which is, you know, the connection between these extensive and diffuse and centuries old connections between the islands. And then also the crystallization of the story of the sea in these remarkable metaphors. So like when poor Jonathan Swift was on his way back to see his lover Stella, who was lying very sick in Dublin. met adverse winds, couldn't sail from Chester, took the hazardous overland route to Holyhead, stuck there for several days, and wrote his Holyhead journal, where he described himself as being stuck in the very worst spot in Wales under the very worst circumstances.
Yeah, he wrote a little ditty here, which I'll give you. Lo, here I sit at Holyhead with muddy ale and mouldy bread, all Christian victual stink of fish, it's where my enemies would wish. There you go. Actually, just jumping ahead to the contemporary situation, just in relation to my own children, right? It just struck me, they've never had to take the boat to Holyhead and the bloody train journey to London. And the thing was, to get to anywhere else, you had to take that journey first. And this must have had a huge effect, I'm presuming, on the kind of worldview of the younger generation. They just hop on a plane.
So, well, it's only lately I saw a tweet there by Philip Boucher Hayes saying, oh my God, I'm stuck in Holyhead, nowhere to go, nothing to do.
We've all been there. Right?
It's a perennial experience, and that kind of idea of the occasional port, piece of occasional port literature that you might write now is a tweet rather than a journal. But it was very much part of the experience. And of course, again, as with the thing about the Irish Sea, is there are very few phases of history you can just simply put into the past. They continue, they persist. It's just we don't always see them.
And apologies to anyone from Holyhead who's listening. I'm sure it's a fine, fine town. Now, listen, this has been mentioned. I want to go back, maybe, David, to you on the question of piracy, smuggling, right? How prevalent was that in Ireland?
I don't think you can really separate Ireland out, particularly in this. I mean, it seems to be prevalent all around the British Isles. Some areas, there seems to be higher concentrations in around Cornwall, etc. And I suppose in around our southern coasts, seems to be a certain amount of it as well in around Donegal. But it is totally there in kind of 19th and even later literature and comment, the whole idea of beating the excise man, whether it's in terms of brandy or tobacco or whatever it is, whatever the luxury good is. But that desire to get the material in, the luxury item, and not pay excise on it, seems to be pretty prevalent.
How porous was the Irish coast to this sort of thing?
I would say it's not that porous at all, really. When you can look at the infrastructure around it, it is a clever smuggler that can get material in by night, preferably by night and in bad weather, to try and beat the excise man and actually get it into the west coast of Ireland or get it into up around Donegal or whatever. But I suppose even today, when you look at some of those areas, there are such a remove and such desolate coasts that if you knew the coast area well, you could play that cat and mouse game and get material in. I mean, we still see drug smugglers trying to do it in the modern age, trying to evade the infrastructure that we have in place for that.
Aoife wants to come in on this, yeah?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that one of the more interesting things of smuggling, or pulling the wool over the eyes of the establishment, is how it's a kind of subversive local act and how it's remembered within local communities very much as a kind of a two fingers to the authorities. And that's something that happens in garrison towns as well, where they are incredibly dependent upon the contract provisions, but they attempt to, pull one over the lads, the quartermasters in the barracks. So there's these tales from Newbridge and from other garrison towns where the farmers would drive the cattle through the gate and then drive them out another gate and bring them back in and get paid twice for the same cattle. This kind of attempt to subvert the relationship between the very powerful economic force and those who are dependent upon it. And I think that's how smuggling, even though it doesn't happen in garrison towns, is an attempt to rip off the army at every opportunity.
That has never gone away. I mean, what Aoife says there has never gone away. We kind of like to think that this is the smuggling, the tax evasion, whatever it is. We've never got away from that culture, despite the fact that in the modern circumstances, what we're ripping off is the Irish state. But ultimately, it's seen as a good crime, and you will still find people who will, take delight in getting something in and not paying customs and not paying tax on it. I'll even fess up here. My own mother used to take delight in going away on foreign holidays and coming back with a suitcase clanking with stuff and getting it. And she took great delight in the fact that she hadn't paid taxes on this, despite the fact it is now the Irish state that's it's the subject of the avoidance. We've never got away from that idea.
Well, when I was a child in Ballyshannon, it was butter. Butter was a
butter,
big
butter
item.
Under the seat.
Half the price.
Cigarettes.
Half the price.
You know. We still do it.
And again, I'm assuming what this suggests to me, that this means that there is a low-level confrontation going on constantly. Would that be correct, Aoife? You know, and presumably this provides a template for political confrontation, which, of course, will only flare up periodically. But during these so-called quiet periods, it means it's always this interaction between locals trying to get one over on the either the Navy or the Army, and the Army or the Coast Guard trying to suppress it, you know. So that's like background noise there the whole time. Incidentally, in the next issue of History Ireland, the September-October issue, there is a review of a very interesting local book by Connie Kelleher, The Alliance of Pirates, Ireland and Atlantic Piracy in the Early 17th Century. I had to get that plug in there. Now, Aoife, I want to come back to you just in relation to the social effect of military establishments. What role did women play in all of this? I mean, the obvious one is prostitution, right? It's the obvious one that crops up. But presumably there's more to it than that.
Sex work is obviously an important industry within garrison towns, although it's not always easy to find in the sources because there's such reticence within local newspapers to even talk about it. You know, I think it's interesting how in British local newspapers, how they can be quite radical on social questions, and the Irish provincial press are quite restrained. But apart from sex work, a lot of women marry soldiers. And in fact, they make quite deliberate conscious choice to marry NCOs, the non-commissioned officers. And a number of soldier memoirs, the ordinary soldiers are complaining that the girls won't look at them because they're just privates. And, you know, they're only interested in sergeants. And the reason they're interested in sergeants is because these are men who can guarantee you a certain standard of living if you marry them, because you marry on the strength. So it's permitted to be married as a sergeant if he gets permission from his commanding officer. So these women can then travel with the regiment and go all over the world, courtesy of the British Army. So women are certainly using it, I think, as a form of assisted emigration to get out of regional Ireland and to get out respectably, you know, and have their passage paid. But even if they're not married on the strength, a surprising number of women are willing to marry soldiers. And they do know that the conditions are pretty awful for women who aren't part of the establishment, but they continue to marry them. And I think it just shows you that soldiers, as well as being seen as drunken and loutish, are also young men in the prime of their physical life who are wearing really nice clothes. I mean, they're extremely well-dressed compared to the average laboring man. Most of them are laborers, you know, they're unskilled, they're largely illiterate or semi-literate, but they're wearing tailored suits. They're beautifully dressed in colored clothing. They play music, they march, they look good, and they're fed regularly. So they're a little bit better physically than the average laborer.
If you want to check that out, check out Barry Lyndon, right? I mean, it was slated that absolutely brilliant film, which really catches what you've just said there, that thing of the spectacle of fellas in uniform and so on. And just going back to your point about marrying a soldier, a sailor, being a type of assisted emigration. Just going back to the Holyhead thing, and again, I got this quote from Clare. This is from Frank O'Connor. He says, "An Irishman's private life begins at Holyhead," which is a brilliant quote. Now, Clare, yeah.
Yeah, I had another quick quotation for you there in relation to what Aoife was saying. There's a ballad that's quoted in some of the early 19th century literature about the problems of marrying a soldier. And it's something like, "And as for sailors, I don't admire them. I wouldn't live as a sailor's bride, for in their courting, they're still discoursing things concerning the ocean wide."
Right. Yeah. Now, Lar, I wanted to go to you next because the word empire is in our title, but of course there was more than one empire on the planet, and the Irish were involved in a fair few of them as well.
Yeah, no, there's a strong links, especially in the 19th century, with Irish men fighting in other navies. In particular, John Barry, who was given the title of the founder of the U.S. Navy. And then a smaller country, by Argentina, with William Brown, Admiral William Brown, defeated the Brazilians, he defeated the Spanish. I mean, quite an outstanding naval officer from Foxford, Barry from Wexford. So you see these kind of coastal towns with strong links to the sea. Again, like the famous wild geese, you see Irishmen popping up in other navies, not just in the British Navy. But the presence within the British Navy is quite large. I mean, at Trafalgar in 1805, it's believed to have about 4,000, about a quarter of the sailors on board are actually Irish-born. And when you look at it, it's not just from one part of the world. I would have thought Cork would have been kind of central with its traditions of links with the Royal Navy. But it's all over the country. It's every small maritime village and town is providing that quarter of that Trafalgar. So the contribution of the Irish throughout the kind of 1800s and earlier is quite large into all navies. But even today, you know, quite regularly, the Argentinian Navy comes into Dublin Port every 2 to 3 years and then goes to Foxford and has a ceremony for Admiral Brown. And similarly, the US Navy takes Barry very, very seriously. So within their own traditions, their kind of naval traditions, these two Irishmen are very much seen as founders of their navies.
Now, what about exploration, David? And the Irish play a role there as well?
I think, yeah, absolutely. A very prominent role. I mean, when you come to the post-Napoleonic Wars, really from about 1822 onwards, you see the Royal Navy used in a series of explorations. I mean, they can include, there's a lot of river seeking in around Africa, basically going up the Gambia and Niger rivers and trying to get into the interior of Africa. And essentially, it's a way of using this navy, and it builds up Royal Navy reputation throughout the 19th century. One of the initial key areas is actually the Arctic. And then later on this century, that will switch to the Antarctic. Why go there to these locations? Well, first of all, they're totally unexplored. If you look at maps of the Arctic, of the Antarctic in the 19th century, they're generally blank. So these areas are going to be surveyed. They're also going to be sought out for natural resources. The late 19th century, there's an idea that you might actually be able to mine coal in Antarctica. It's one of the reasons that Scott and Shackleton and whatever else are going exploring these areas. And then also in the Arctic case, there's this quest for a Northwest Passage, this idea that you can sail up to the Arctic off the coast of Canada and go across the top of the world down into the Pacific Ocean, which would, you know, basically halve the time you spend at sea going to China, India, places like that. So it seems very important. Now, in terms of the Irish in those initial phases throughout the 1830s, 1840s, pretty much all the major prominent figures in the Arctic phase are actually Irish. People like Robert McClure, who actually discovers the Northwest Passage. Now, ultimately, it is not of commercial use, but he discovers the Northwest Passage in the 1840s. Captain Crozier, who goes missing with the Franklin expedition again in the 1840s. And then other figures like Leopold McClintock, etc., etc. So they're very, very prominent. And because there's been so much research done on these voyages, there's actually quite a bit of research done on the muster lists for these ships. And about 15-20% of the ordinary sailors of these expeditions were Irish. We associated kind of like in the Irish psyche, we associate with Shackleton and then the discovery of Tom Crean in more recent years, and we associated with the Antarctic. And the Irish are prominent there as well. But it is very, very noticeable in the mid-19th century that the Irish are very heavily involved in the Royal Navy. As it tries, I mean, this is really kind of the exploration and then sending gunboats around the world to hold prop up the empire. They are really the two major expressions of the Royal Navy in the 19th century.
Now, can I come to you on the fishing industry, right? And my first question to you is, why do Irish people eat fish, right? No, because it's one of these mysteries, actually, because I get asked this all the time by tourists. But let's just talk about the fishing industry here. How important was that to our story?
It's funny enough, if you look at books from the 1800s, they complain that fishing is controlled by the English. So the trawling, the kind of fleets that are coming are using Irish waters to take fish and bring it back to England. So that's one of the reasons why we don't have that tradition of eating fish, is that the fish, even if it is being...
The Brits had it all.
If you talk to the people involved in fishing today, they'll complain that, you know, their fish is going to France, it's going, you know, it's not coming into Ireland. And the same complaints are being written in the middle of the 1800s when people looked at the fishing industry. So in response, towards the end of the 1800s, the congested district board is established, and that very much focuses on building those piers that we associate along the west coast of Ireland and harbours to kind of create an industry that wasn't there before. And even when you look at kind of fishing fleets in Dublin, the fleet that we associate with Ringsend, which is beside Dublin Port, that fleet actually mainly came from Brixham. So it's coming from Devon. And again, Brixham is the centre of fishing even today in England. And what they did in the kind of 1700s, 1800s is they kind of expanded. They took over ports all along the Irish Sea, fishing from Ringsend, but the fish essentially going to markets elsewhere. And that's herring and later on, of course, a mackerel, but herring would be the big industry of the 19th century. So to answer your question, I mean, there isn't that tradition of eating fish. The fish is being exported. When you look at salmon and sea trout in the rivers are controlled by landed estates. So therefore, poaching is your only option, quite a dangerous option to do at that time. And then the knowledge of the sea, which might have been there in the 1700s, is declining once you get into the 1800s. And that's, again, with the Active Union, more kind of links in with the British Empire. And Ireland had its own independent trade.
It's like, just go back there, Laura. You're saying knowledge of the sea is declining. Why is that?
Ireland in the 1700s has merchants. Merchants have their own ships. Those ships are going to France and to Spain. So there is that connectivity. And I'm assuming that something similar is happening with that knowledge of the sea. Once you get past into 1801, the Royal Navy has controlled the seas and does become the greatest navy until World War II. In many ways, any links with the sea are gone for the Irish unless you join the Royal Navy. And if you see ports like Dublin Port, which maybe 40-60% of trade is with other countries, after 1801, what you start to see is everything is coming through England. So we become an appendage to Britain. In many ways, Dublin Port is the largest port today, but in the 1800s, Liverpool is the port. I mean, that's most things are coming in from around the world into Liverpool. They're then broken up into smaller shipments and then sent over to Ireland and then sold mainly by British merchants using the railway network. So there's a huge change in the 1800s with Ireland's relationship with the sea. And that kind of ties in a point that Claire was making earlier on about the impact of the empire. In many ways, that kind of ties in with the theme of sea blindness, is that we kind of lost that link.
Mm. I want to move on to the post-independence period. But before I do, there's a question of slavery, right? And David, I want to bring you in there because you mentioned it right at the get-go as one of the elements in this Atlantic world. Now, of course, this is controversial at the moment with the Black Lives Matter movement, the toppling of certain statues and so on. So does Ireland have an unblemished record in this regard? This is something that's nothing to do with us.
I'm afraid, like the anarchist Emile Henry made that statement years ago, there are no innocents. So I'm afraid we don't have an unblemished record here. Nene Rogers has written about this, and indeed she's written about it in History of Ireland. It's a very good summation of Ireland's involvement in the slave trade. And we basically see in that period when Britain is obtaining its forced empire, so to speak, in the West Indies and America, there's a huge need for labour, and that labour comes from slaves, essentially, in West Africa. We find Irish individuals involved in this. We find efforts to develop Irish companies to engage in this, basically to get free labour to support in the plantations. There's always been, I think historically, there was always an assumption that this was the business of, Irish ascendancy, Protestants, etc. But Nene Rogers has shown that Irish Catholic merchants and groupings of Irish Catholic merchants were involved in this. So I'm afraid we don't have a stainless record in this respect. And even when the Irish Times ran an article on this only recently. When you look at the posts, when slavery is abolished and you look at the compensation that is given out to compensate former slave owners. There's a very good record of our involvement across the country. And then we even come across, I remember years ago coming across even local tales that I suppose would be embedded in Irish folklore. I remember coming across a case of in an Irish port town that I won't name the town, but there was a house that nobody could live in because anybody living in it, they were kept awake at night by the sounds of crying children. And the local librarian, who was also the local historian, did a bit of work. And it turns out that the house had been owned by a merchant captain who had been involved in the slave trade out of Liverpool, etc. So there are, you know, whether it's embedded in Irish folklore, and but also there's a documentary evidence here that we were involved.
Claire, you want to come in on that?
Just, it's such an interesting one, the legacies of British slave ownership database, what David's referring to. It's at UCL. I heard Nick Draper, who runs the database, talking about it a little while ago at a thing in UCD. And he was reminding everyone that the reason that database exists is because Daniel O'Connell in Parliament asked for the compensations to be recorded. So the information that's now being kind of digitized and interrogated in new ways, and their website is amazing. The kind of contextual stuff that's on it is there because of what O'Connell said. And Draper also said that on the one hand, relative to population size, there are a relatively small number of Irish beneficiaries on that list. But he also said that there's a pattern whereby Irish merchants coming back from the West Indies would buy country houses in England and register that as their address when they receive their compensation. So there's a lot of work still to do in actually finding out the fuller patterns of who benefited in Ireland and how, and where the money went, because that's what that database does, is it tracks where the slave money then later goes.
Right. Now, I want to move on, guys, because I just look at the time here. Lara, I want to bring you in just about the War of Independence and the Civil War. What role did the sea play in those conflicts?
Well, it goes back further to 1916. You know, we always kind of remember the Aude being captured, but the Royal Navy knew the shipment was coming from Germany. They knew submarines were coming. They'd already cracked the Croats. So it plays an essential role in 1916 in essentially, you know, stopping the rising, because once the guns are captured, that's it and over and done with. During the War of Independence, there's regular attacks on the Coast Guard that David has mentioned earlier on. They were equipped with weapons, so they were a natural target. And then ships are there to stop the importation of weapons. Again, they control the sea. So you have this issue with the Irish volunteers and the IRAs, that they never have control of importing their own weapons, because the sea is owned and controlled by the Royal Navy. But it's really in the Civil War that you start to see the kind of principle, and the British had done this for years in the various wars in Ireland, is that the Free State Army uses passenger ships to move down to Cork and land in Cork. Famously, they landed in Kerry, of course, bringing down the Irish Guard. But even go up along the west coast, Westport is also a town that is relieved by the Free State using the water. So those are just standard BNI ships that are used heavily up-armoured, and then they're able to go around the anti-treaty forces. So really, it's during the Civil War that you see the advantage. Whoever has the artillery, whoever has the armoured cars, but in particular, if you have the ships, you can move them around very, very quickly and surround the enemy very, very quickly.
So, Larry, would it be true to say then that the Irish Civil War was won and lost on the sea?
It was won and lost on the sea, yeah. And again, the other one is artillery. The Free State Army only had 9 artillery guns. But as we saw in 1798, whoever has the artillery in Ireland will always win the battles. And that's essentially what happened during the Civil War. It's the sea, command of the sea. Ironically, of course, after that, after 1922-23, with the treaty and the treaty ports being kept, in many ways, you start to see this beginning, the state sea blindness, where there's no real interest in the sea. The kind of interest in fisheries is carried on through BIM and kind of building of trawlers. But fundamentally, there's no real interest or kind of at a governmental level to deal with the sea until the outbreak of World War II.
Yeah, so the attitude I said that the Civil War was won by the Free State side on the sea, but they didn't continue the interest in it.
The modern Navy, the Marine Service was established at the outbreak of war in 1939. You also had a maritime inscription, a reserve element established in 1942 in Dublin Port. And these are all very, very late decisions. And it's only after World War II that you start to see a kind of an understanding, again, not really at government level, but definitely within the Navy itself and within people kind of who served in the Navy, a need to kind of take this seriously. Irish shipping, of course, is established in 1941 for the same reason as that we needed our own merchant navy. and we didn't have one as an island nation. That's a huge strategic threat. So these are all kind of late realizations by a state which had been established in 1922.
David, your dad was a seaman, wasn't he, with Irish Shipping?
No, he was never with Irish Shipping. He went to sea when he was very, very young. He went to sea when he was
12. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah.
Very early 1950s. So he was never Irish Shipping. He would have been kind of like people like BP on tankers. There was a family owned line called Morphy Palgrave out of Liverpool. He worked for them. Also some of the Nordic, some of the Baltic kind of companies. But never Irish Shipping.
And how long would he be away at a stretch?
Well, he left the sea when he got married. So I never experienced him being away as a sailor. But I mean, there was one stage he went away and he wasn't back in Ireland for something like 18 months. And that was very much, I mean, a young man in his teens in Dublin with nothing doing and family sake. But that was very much by choice. He signed on a commission that took him to a certain area. And then he picked up another job with another ship and he wanted to circumnavigate the world. So he spent about 18 months doing that. And that was a common enough experience. He would come home then. There used to be on the quays, there used to be a merchant shipping kind of office where basically if you were qualified, you could go in and decide what ship you want to go on next, pick up your next job.
Presumably this was very similar to the experience of Irish seasonal workers. I mean, I know from my childhood, I knew many people whose dad was away in England. You wouldn't see him for 6 months. So this was quite a common experience, I'm presuming.
I think it is. And there is an element of choice because you can choose what way you're going to play it. I mean, to a certain extent, he was a young unmarried man, so he wanted to go and see various places and do things and see a bit of the world. But he could have chosen just to get himself a slot, say, on a Dublin-Liverpool ship. And be backward and forwards a couple of times a week and then always be able to come home to his own bed, so to speak. So there was an element of choice in this regarding where people were in their age, career, family life, etc.
Now, Aoife, you want to come in on this?
These connections that people have with the sea, you know, even when they leave the sea or indeed when they're discharged from the army, they're still connected often through pensions, which is something that continued throughout the life, the early years of the independent state. There are a lot of pensioners who are subsisting either from the Royal Navy or from the British Army. And they are a very important way in which, you know, family economies can continue to function in these garrison towns and port towns, even after the tumultuous effects of the 20s. I mean, my grandfather was raised by a Royal Naval pensioner. And that is, as far as I know, the only ancestor I have who had anything to do with the Navy or the or the Army. But he continued to draw down his weekly subsistence, you know, throughout the early 20th century. And I think that's an important way of continuity continuing even after independence, how the legacy of the British Empire and Irish people's involvement in that continued to support the local economies.
It comes back to something Claire was saying earlier on about basically where we orient ourselves and where we direct ourselves. I mean, I think even apart from the money aspect, the later connections, you will find people who might have personal connections with far-flung areas of the world. They might be living in Cork. They may rarely go to Dublin, but they might have a regular letter correspondence with somebody in Buenos Aires or somebody in Canada, and they might have family living there. I know from my own father's point of view, he had associates and friends from his days kind of all around the world, and he kept in contact with them and occasionally would go visit them. So he had a very outward-looking kind of vision of the world. He saw Ireland in a much more global context and where he could go in a more global context, which is an interesting little facet. When you think about it, those kind of links afterwards.
Okay, David, can I just say, this has been touched on before, right? Just going back to independence. Did independence cut us off, if you like, from our naval tradition? From our British naval tradition?
Well, I think from the British, and Lara's marked this idea of sea blindness. I think the sea blindness is actually now incorporates all our naval traditions, whether it's American or whether it's Russian or French or whatever, but definitely from the British tradition. And as Lara's mentioned, it would break us away from that and the point of view that they actually do the heavy lifting, so to speak, through the treaty ports for our coastal defence up until the 1930s. So there's that kind of like break and we lose sight of it. And we don't create, as a modern nation and through our modern naval service. We have not really created a new naval tradition for ourselves. And then even coming down to, say, the merchant shipping idea, Irish shipping, founded in 1941, wound up in 1984. I actually cannot think of another island nation at the moment that doesn't have a national shipping company, because, you know, because the sea is there and it's strategically we need it. But we don't have that anymore. So we have kind of, as we're a peculiar island nation that we've turned our sea, our back on the sea in a modern practical terms. But we've all more or less dismissed all our, like the heritage, the traditions that the over centuries that the country had with naval aspects, regardless of whose navy it was.
Yeah, Lara, you're working for Dublin Ports, so you're the only man with skin in the game here. What do you have to say about this?
No, I totally agree with David. And I think it's a point that was made earlier on. You know, we're all of a certain age that we, you know, we had that rite of passage on the Holyhead trip, and it was normally on a B&I ship, which was 20 years too old and should have been retired. And the, you know, the younger generation, anyone of a certain, under a certain age, you just hop on a plane and you kind of lose that kind of link, the fact that we're an island. Because you're hopping on a plane, you can go anywhere in the world very, very quickly. While the reality, as Claire said, you know, throughout the 19th century was, there was this moment where you were going to get off the island. It was going to be an experience, and it could be a terrible one for people like Swift before the steamship comes along. So it's something that I've noticed working in the ports. Dublin Port is the biggest port in the country. It's not a title it had 20, 30 years ago. But it's become very, very central, because everyone who is importing or exporting wants to come into the big city and get their goods off their trucks as quickly as possible. But we are, what you see outside the office every day is this amazing supply chain linking us on the traditional route to Holyhead and to Liverpool, but also now new routes to Belgium and Holland. And you're starting to see bigger and bigger ships. The biggest ship that comes in at the moment has road space on board for 8 kilometres of trucks. That's a huge amount of trucks coming off. And we need that connectivity, because essentially everything that's in our house, and even the books behind me, has been imported at some stage. As an island nation, we kind of still have an agricultural economy, which is quite small. We have this international economy now based on big American companies, but we don't produce the IKEA furniture. We don't produce most of our food stuff that we like to eat, like our pastas, which is taken over from the potato. So in reality, everything that we kind of see around in our own houses and our offices at some stage has been on a container, which is kind of ties back to what David's saying about the sea blindness. For an island nation, it's very unusual that we kind of have lost that link. And as David said, you know, if you talk to Royal Navy people, or if you talk to the US Navy, they say the same things happening to their countries, is that this link with the sea has gone completely, unless you're taking a cruise holiday.
It won't be too many of them shortly, I suspect.
They're in decline. A lot of their ships now tied up, and probably will be for about 2 years.
Claire, I want to bring you in, actually. I did refer to this earlier, you know, that nowadays very few travellers arrive in Ireland by sea, right? So how has this altered, like, literary perceptions, either by the Irish or people from outside Ireland?
Well, as ever with the sea, it doesn't go away, Tommy. So it's a mistake, I think, to kind of have this narrative of technological progress where there used to be roads and then there was railways and then there was steam and, you know, and so on. In fact, it's true in Ireland, and it's true in lots of post-colonial contexts. All these things interweave and overlap for decades and decades and decades. And so there's still lots of people traveling by ferry. There may well be more to come. You can see the kind of the legacies and the traces of the journey. So, for example, Kevin Barry's wonderful story, Beer Trip to Clandidno, which has nothing to do with the Irish Sea or a sea crossing, traces this incredible arc along the northwest coast of Wales of all the kind of seaside holiday towns that grew up around the needs of fashionable Dublin tourists who were travelling over and back the Irish Sea at the end of the 19th century. You know, Joyce went on holidays to Clandidno, for example, didn't go back to Ireland, just went from London to Clandidno. So you have these, you have the kind of the traces and the legacies of these journeys continue. And Tommy, if I can just briefly plug a website called Ports Past and Present, if anyone's interested in thinking freshly about Holyhead or indeed Fishguard, Pembroke Dock, Newport, Dublin Port, and Rosslare. We're starting from this week to kind of tell a new story about one of the ports every week to sort of find new ways of looking at them and thinking about them.
Okay, tell you, just to wrap up, right, I'll go to you with this one, Lara. As I said, the only man with skin in the game here. In the light of two things, one is the ecological problems with air travel, right? That is up for discussion now. And the other is Brexit, right? And I think Brexit brings this discussion nicely full circle, because in our discussion before this, Lara, you kind of posed the question, does Brexit represent the failure of empire? Explain. And I'm going to give you the last word on this.
No, it is, in a sense, it kind of ties in with the decline of the Royal Navy. We have two island nations, United Kingdom and ourselves. And we have, as I mentioned, suffered from sea blindness, but also the UK has kind of shown since 2016 that they also have kind of suffered from sea blindness. Some politicians have been very surprised on TV.
Or just blindness, Lara. Anyway, sorry, yeah. Go on.
Admitting on TV that they were so surprised how many trucks actually were going between Dover and Calais. And how, like ourselves, the United Kingdom is very much tied into a European supply chain that's very much based on ferries and trucks and on the tunnel. There is this kind of disconnect that the United Kingdom has shown. If they're going to put up these new borders, change how they show themselves to the world, it's going to get harder and harder for them to be connected into Europe and into the rest of the world. And it also kind of represents something that's strange about the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy hasn't really had a very large aircraft carrier since the 1960s, 1970s. And they now have two brand new aircraft carriers, one of which is in the last week has been announced is going to be sent to China. So you have almost a Navy that has kind of seen decline, has been overshadowed by the Air Force and by the Army over the last 50 years. Is suddenly now going back into a role that you haven't seen really since the 1940s and 1930s of actually providing a fleet, an aircraft carrier and seven or eight other large ships going around the world, something that really hasn't had the capability. So it's a kind of an exchange what's happened since the Brexit vote and perceptions of how England sees itself in the modern world.
Okay, Lara, I'm going to leave you with the last word on that. This is typical of the head school. You know, we have one head school. It's like nuclear fission. It suggests several more head schools. And Holyhead, definitely, Claire, we'll come back to that one. There's a book to be written on that. Finally, I'd just like to thank our speakers, Aoife Brannock, Claire Connolly, Lara Joy, David Murphy. And our next head school, which will be posted in September, will be looking at the Irish Republic in 1920, and in particular, De Valera's visit to North America. Hope you'll tune in for us next. Thank you very much.